Well, the Bible is filled with many accounts of godly men and godly women who are worthy of our emulation, our deep respect. And of course, we know 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 11 says that all these things were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the age come, for our benefit, that we can learn from them. And so as you go through the lives of the men and women written in the Bible, you gain inspiration. And I guess that's one reason why Paul writes that faith comes by hearing, and hearing the Word of God. When you go through the lives of people like Esther and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and all that they accomplished, it just lifts you up. Today we want to look at an individual and gain some beneficial knowledge from him and the life that he lived that was definitely an example for us. That person is Daniel. He was a man who obtained preeminence and power in his lifetime while he lived. He gained much preeminence and much respect and honor and power during the time in which he lived. Matter of fact, he started out preeminent among the children of Israel. You can read that if you want to open up to the book of Daniel, in Daniel chapter 1, the first six verses talks about Daniel, and we know that he was one of the captives taken by Nebuchadnezzar to Babylon, and it tells us that he was obviously part of the royal household when he lived in Jerusalem. And he was taken captive in verse 3 of the first chapter of Daniel. It says, "Then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles." So he had preeminence even within the household of Judah. "Men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, in whom they might teach the language and the literature of the Chaldeans." So he'd been in the household, the royal household, so Nebuchadnezzar felt that these individuals could be taken and trained in the way of the Babylonians and benefit him. "And the king appointed for him them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine such as he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king." So again, Daniel had preeminence when he was young. As a matter of fact, he was very young when he came into Babylon. You'll find, if you look at verses 17 through 20, that he gained preeminence among the wise men of Babylon. Notice that. We're already in chapter 1. Just turn over to verse 17. It says, As for these four young men, that would be Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Daniel, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now at the end of the days, when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Then the king interviewed them, and among them all, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, as we know them. Therefore, they served before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in his realm. And then it talks about Daniel continued, basically in a very powerful capacity, into the first year of King Cyrus. So he went through a number of kings and was prominent in the eyes of those with whom he served. If you notice Daniel chapter 2, Daniel chapter 2 and verse 48, not going to go into the fact that Daniel was able to interpret a dream for Nebuchadnezzar, the image of gold, but he did a great job, obviously. And then you look at verse 48, it says, "Then the king Nebuchadnezzar promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over the wise men of Babylon. And of course, Daniel petitioned for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to also be advanced in prominence with the kingdom, and the king adhered to that. So again, we see an individual here who was able to be prominent, as we might say, a Christian today. It's not wrong to have prominence in great positions in kingdoms of this world. We're going to discuss that a little bit as we progress. Then chapter 5, verse 29. Chapter 5 and verse 29. And this was the writing of the wall that Belshazzar saw, you know, the many, many tinko euphorsin. And Daniel again was able to handle that. And then if you look at verse 29, it says, then Belshazzar gave the command that they clothe Daniel with purple, put a gold chain, a chain of gold around his neck, and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be third ruler in the kingdom. Third ruler in the kingdom. Pretty preeminent within the kingdom. And of course, we know that night Belshazzar lost his life. Verse 31 says, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. And let's continue reading then in verse 1. And it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom. And over these, three governors, of which Daniel was one. So a whole other kingdom takes over. And Daniel, again, is prominent in that he is one of the three governors. And then verse 3 says, then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors because an excellent spirit was in him. And the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm, where he would be second only to the king himself. Now, how was Daniel able to reach these positions of power and influence without compromising his position as a godly man? You see, often in worldly kingdoms, even here in the United States, people get their success because they purchase it, or they are bootleggers, or whatever. Now, I'm not saying all are that way. There are probably some pretty prominent individuals who did have some kind of integrity. You just don't see a whole lot of that today, especially within our governmental structure. But how was Daniel able to reach these positions without compromising being a godly man? If we take a close look at the book of Daniel, it does reveal Daniel's secret. It shows how we then can be successful without selling our souls. Now, how many here are familiar with Faust? There's a book written by it. Okay, we've got a couple, Faust, and they've had a couple of movies based on that. Faust was an individual who sold, what did he do? He sold his soul to the devil so that he could get power and prestige and wealth. They had a movie that I saw when I was a young kid called Damn Yankees. Anybody remember that movie? It was a movie about a gentleman who was an avid Washington Senators baseball fan, and they lost all the time to the Yankees. And he wanted to change that, and so Satan thought, I've got a way to gain another soul, as the movie goes. The young man's name was Joe Boyd, and Satan offered him the availability to be a Washington Senator baseball player and become prominent and take the Yankees down. And so he became known as Joe Hardy. Now, the story, you know, goes along where he's doing wonderful things for the Senators, and they're defeating the Yankees, their rival, and they're going to end up, you know, winning the World Series because he's such an awesome baseball player. And but Hardy was wise enough to get an escape clause, which Satan didn't want to give him. But the only way that Satan could get a hold of Hardy was if he put this escape clause in. And as the movie goes along, he's enjoying himself, blah, 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 but it progresses to get a little bit worse for him. And finally he decides, this is not a good deal for me. And so he exercises his escape clause. And of course, he goes back to being Joe Boyd, who was barely able to walk and chew gum at the same time, as opposed to being this awesome baseball player. And so it turns out okay in the end that he ends up not having to give his soul over to Satan. But a lot of people are willing to sell their souls. And I'm sure many of you are aware of individuals who, matter of fact, my wife and I think were, was it today or yet, listening about these MS-13 gang members that had to do horrendous murders and videotape it to become part of the gang. So a lot of people sell their souls to who knows whom, to gain advantage. You know, it's sad. So Daniel was a person who did not sell his soul out, but stayed faithful to God in spite of all the things that came his way, the pressures, the difficulties, the threats. He held on and was given great preeminence in many different kingdoms. So first of all, we notice that even as a young teenager, Daniel was a man of purpose. He was a man of purpose. So it doesn't, you know, you don't have to be older to be a man or a woman of purpose, but he was a man of purpose. And he was a young boy in a strange land, and depending upon what commentary you read, some will have him anywhere from 15 to 25 years of age at this time. Most say he was a teenager. So he was a young boy in a strange land when he first arrived in Babylon. And he was immediately faced with a challenge to violate God's law by eating the king's food. You know, foods that probably were not good for him. Definitely probably not even correct for a young Jewish lad to eat. And despite his youth and the obvious pressures to confirm, Daniel purposed in his heart. He purposed in his heart to uphold the law of God no matter the cost. Notice that again in Daniel chapter 1, or in the beginning part of Daniel. He was a man of purpose. Daniel chapter 1, and we've already read the first five verses, so let's pick it up in verse 6. Now from among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah. To them the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He gave Daniel Belteshazzar, to Hanani Shadrach, and to Mishael. He gave Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. In verse 8, but Daniel, as a young lad, purposed in his heart. He purposed in his heart. He was convicted in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. He purposed. He was intent that he was just not going to do this. He wasn't going to conform, no matter what the cost. There's something that causes people to have a deep respect for those who have this type of conviction. You know, they may not like the individual, but they are, shall we say, deeply impressed by the conviction of the individual who stands his ground. Because of his willingness to put God first, God granted Daniel favor in the sight of others. You notice verse 1, it says, now God had brought Daniel into favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. Make a long story short, Daniel makes this bargain with him that you just let us for 10 days do this and eat this porridge, so to speak, and vegetables, and let the others have these the rich foods of the king. After 10 days, evaluate who looks better. And of course, Daniel did, as well as the other lads with him. Now, peer pressure is a tremendous thing. Now, while he's doing all of this, you can imagine the peer pressure from all the others who are in the same entourage, and the peer pressure of the noblemen in Babylon, the peer pressure from the eunuch who said, in essence, if I allow this, the king finds out, I may lose my head. But we'll give you 10 days. You know, how many who know what who Dr. Dobson is? Anybody? You know, wrote many number of books, you know, on child-rearing, etc. And there's a story that I read many, many moons ago when Dr. Dobson was, again, writing about teenagers and how you can be an example to those around you and not giving in to the peer pressure around you. And he tells the story about these six boys who were in an automobile. And they were driving down the road. And the driver, of course, was big man in town because he had the car that they were riding in, right? So he was the big boy. And it says that as they were driving down the road, the driver pulls out a weed, marijuana, lights it up, takes a puff, and hands it to the guy sitting next to him in the front seat. Now, the guy sitting next to him has what? A little peer pressure to go along because this is the big boy who just handed him a weed. And so he takes the marijuana, takes a puff off of it, and hands it to the guy sitting next to him by the door. Now, how about the guy who's sitting by the door? How much peer pressure does he have? Well, he's got, number one, the big boy in town, plus the guy sitting next to him took a puff. Now, he's got a lot of pressure to conform to the group, right? So he takes a puff, or takes the marijuana, takes a puff, and he hands it to the guy right behind him in the back seat. Now, how much pressure does he have? It's building, right? Driver, guy in the middle, guy next to him. This young lad, Dr. Dobson says, took the cigarette in his hand, said, "Nah, I don't do this stuff." Handed it to the guy next to him in the back seat. Now, what did this guy just do for the other two in the back seat? He just removed all of the pressure. You know, he just, shall we say, hit the relief valve. Pressure in the middle, pressure on him. He says, "No, thank you," and hands it. The guy in the middle next to him has all the pressure removed, and he says, "I don't think I want any either." Handed it to the guy next to him, and he also said, "I don't think I want a puff on it either." So by standing up to that which, for that which was right, he not only benefited himself, but also benefited the two next to him. Now, I don't know. Maybe the two next to him, one of them would have said, "I don't care." We just don't know, you know, if he had taken a puff. But the point being is that when you have confidence and you purpose in your heart and you stand strong for what you believe, it does impact other people around you. They may not agree with your religious beliefs, but they have a deep respect for the fact that you are able to stand up for what you do believe. Because of his willingness to put God first, again, God granted Daniel favor in the sight of others. Now, we don't know how God chose to do that. He just did, but he did. And can you think of someone else who benefited from the blessings of God because he held his ground when it came to his belief? There's a similar story of another gentleman, Joseph, exactly. Matter of fact, turn over to Genesis chapter 39. Genesis chapter 39. And we'll be reading in verse 1. Again, we know the story without going back and rehearsing all of it, how Joseph ended up being sold into slavery by his brothers. He was taken down to Egypt. In verse 1 it says, "And Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, brought him from the Ishmaelites, I get it out here yet, who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And the master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in the sight and served him. Then he made him overseer." Okay, Potiphar made him overseer of his house. "And all that he had he put under his authority. So it was from that time that he made him overseer of his house and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was in all that he had in the house and in the field. Thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hand and did not know." He did not know what he had, except for the bread which he ate. Joseph controlled everything. And yet he was down in Egypt as a slave. And how did it turn out? Well, we know that Satan had a hand in this because he set Potiphar's wife on Joseph, yet Joseph held his ground. And I believe, my heart tells me, that Potiphar knew that Joseph was innocent because of how Joseph conducted himself. But this was his wife, right? And so Joseph ends up in prison. How does that turn out? Joseph could have compromised greatly even being there, but he didn't. He held his ground. And to make a long story short, he found favor in Pharaoh's sight because he was able to interpret this dream. And how'd Joseph do? Daniel became third in all of Babylon. And Darius thought about making him two with the Medes and Persians. Without, again, reading the story, Joseph became second in all of Egypt. I would call that a pretty prominent position for the life that he lived at that particular time. That's why I say it's not wrong to be given authority or power within a government. But how you conduct yourself is of the utmost importance within that structure that you are given. Matter of fact, Proverbs 16, verse 7, I'm not going to turn there, says, "The gods even to make your enemies to be at peace with you." And Joseph had his enemies, and Daniel definitely has his, and we'll see that in a moment. So every child of God, each and every one of us, needs to be a person of purpose, as was Daniel. You know, no one respects a wishy-washy person, someone with no direction in their life. James 1:8, if you want to turn over there, fine. But it says, "A double-minded man or a double-minded woman is unstable in all his or her ways." And you'll find there's very little respect in somebody who just wavers back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. So it's good to have planning and purpose in your everyday life. And of course, we know Matthew 6:33 gives us the ultimate purpose, right, in each Christian's life, and that is seek you first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. We do everything we can to make sure we please our Father and our big brother in heaven. And then God can make things work out for you as these two. I have an example that I've used all the time. It's, to me, an example for the times in which we live. This goes back many years ago, but it's still for our day and age. Around the early part of the 70s, I was a young minister, an associate, as a matter of fact, at the end of a circuit. And there was a member who was being threatened by his foreman where he worked, that if he went to the Feast of Tabernacles, he would fire him and he would not have a job when he got back. Would you call that pressure? What does your job do for you? It pays your mortgage or your rent, puts food on the table, pays the car note, you know, any number of things. You lose your job, all that, a lot of pressure, a lot of pressure. Well, the man went to the feast. You know, he was very convicted and dedicated Christian. He went to the Feast of Tabernacles. And as he was going, his foreman said, when you get back, you won't have a job. So he went. When he got home from the feast, he went ahead and went to work. And the foreman was very cold towards him and evidently was looking for any reason to fire him because he couldn't go to the feast without any problem legally. And the foreman, as talking with this gentleman, just gave him fits for 2 or 3 weeks after he got back, looking for anything he could to terminate his employment. Now, thankfully, the boss, the owner of the company, liked this guy. He didn't deal with him regularly, but he did like him. He also had a very good reputation among his fellow workers. It was just his foreman that didn't like him, you know, going up against what he told him he couldn't do, right? Kind of reminds me of when I was sophomore in high school in South Bend, Indiana, and I had to go to the feast, and I had Spanish as a class, and my Spanish teacher says, you can't go. You go right now, at the beginning of the year, you'll be lost when it comes to Spanish. You can't go. I said, well, I've got to go. I said, God commands me to go. His words, quote, can God fail you? He threatened me with failing me in the class, you know. Thankfully, when I got back, we moved to Michigan, so I didn't have to deal with them. But this guy came back and was tormented. Well, ironically enough, guess what happened? The foreman was fired. I don't know why, but the foreman was fired, and guess who got the foreman's job? This member got the foreman's job. He held fast to the truth, was convicted about what he did. He was a man of purpose. And God took care of him. He didn't just keep his job. He got the foreman's job. And to me, that's how it should work, right? That's how it should work when you serve the living God. So it was an inspirational story, nevertheless, to me and all the members there in Uniontown, Pennsylvania, you know, where he was a member. So we want to dare to be a Daniel and be a person who has great purpose. And the greatest purpose of all is being part of the kingdom of God and following in God's righteousness. So not only throughout Daniel's life did he have a strong sense of purpose, he also was a man of principle. He was a man of principle. We should be men and women of principle. Now, we read earlier how as a young man he refused to eat the king's meat. Daniel 1 and verse 8 just referenced that. He had principle. And as an old man, by refusing the gifts of Belshazzar, notice that in Daniel chapter 5. Daniel chapter 5. Daniel chapter 5. And already referenced this earlier as well. There, you know, Belshazzar made a great feast for thousands of his lords. And this magical writing appears on the wall. Meanie, meanie, tickle you forcing it. None of the magicians or his quote-unquote right wise men, astrologers, could answer him. And the king's wife said, well, there's this guy in your kingdom called Daniel. And he was of a great servant to your father, Nebuchadnezzar. who was able to interpret his dreams. Why don't you call him and see what he can do for you? So he does. And he says, if you can answer, tell my dream, then I will set you again above nobles. I'll deck you out in purple. And Daniel chapter 5, and let's start reading in verse 13. So then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, are you that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? I have heard of you. The Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men and astrologers have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not give the interpretation to the king. And I have heard of you that you can give interpretations and explain enigmas. Now if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be again third ruler in the kingdom. And notice how Daniel answered. He was a man of principle. I think most people, if they had this ability, would have said, great, I'll take that gold chain. Yeah, maybe you can move me up to second in charge of the kingdom, not just third. No. Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Yet, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation, which is exactly what he did. He read and gave the interpretation to the king. If you notice Daniel chapter 6, and I may come back to this one a little bit later, specifically verse 10, a man of principle. This is the story where Daniel was given preeminence over all the governors and satraps because of the excellent spirit that was in him, as we read already in verse 3. So the governors and the other men of renown, quote unquote, sought to find some charge against Daniel. They were jealous. We want to get rid of this guy. I mean, after all, he's just a captive from another land, you know, and we are from this kingdom. And so they tried to set a trap for him so that he could be put to death. Again, long story short, we're very familiar with, they tricked Darius into making this decree, right? The law of the Medes and the Persians, that if anyone bowed down or worshiped anyone or anything else besides the king for 30 days, that they would be cast into the lion's den. Now, this is for anybody, but we know that they didn't have everybody in mind. They had Daniel in mind. And then if you notice then, in verse 10, now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, it was sealed, it was delivered, it could not be changed, law of the Medes and the Persian, he went home, and in his upper room, with his windows open towards Jerusalem. You know why they pray towards Jerusalem, right? Right? Remember Solomon's request? You know, if any of your people be in a foreign land and they kneel down and pray towards Jerusalem, you will hear and you will forgive. So Daniel was in the upper room facing Jerusalem. He knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as his custom since early days. So this wasn't just something he did that day. It was his custom that he did. And it says, these men assembled in verse 11, found Daniel praying and making supplications before his God. They knew Daniel prayed with his window open towards Jerusalem. So what do you think after the decree was signed they did? They camped outside his window, right? They camped out in the street had their binoculars, you know, going to see what Daniel does. They knew what he was going to do. And sure enough, he does it. Boy, let's run back to the king now and get Daniel's life taken from him. And of course, Darius. Well, let's just read it, beginning of verse 6. So these governors thronged before the king and said to him, King Darius, live forever. And all the governors of the kingdoms and the administrations, the counselors, the advisors, have consulted together to establish a royal statue, right? And that if someone doesn't bow down, they'll be cast into the lion's den, verse 7. So now we jump over to verse 11. These men assembled and found Daniel praying. Verse 12, and they went before the king, spoke concerning the king's decree. Have you not signed the decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days except you should be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, the thing is true. It's exactly what happened, according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which does not alter. So they answered and said before the king, that Daniel, see, the king didn't know what Daniel had done. That Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you have signed, but makes his petition three times a day before his God. And when the king heard these words, he was greatly displeased, not with Daniel, but with whom? Himself. He knew he'd been set up. Ah, it dawns. He was displeased with himself, and he was broken of heart, because Daniel was very special in his eyes, and he knew the ability of Daniel, and knew that Daniel was a man of principle. Greatly displeased with himself, and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. How can I make this decree invalid? How can I change this? He set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver all different ideas and concepts and thoughts. Then these men approached the king and said to the king, No, king, and it is the law of the Medes and Persians that no decree or statute which the king establishes may be changed. So they're putting more pressure on the king about this. And of course, the king is probably feeling worse and worse. So the king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. But the king spoke, saying to Daniel, Your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. Now, did the king really believe this? Or was he, shall we say, hoping? Right? So a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signets of his lords, that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. So the king went back to his palace and spent the night fasting. He liked this guy. He liked this guy called Daniel. And no magicians were brought before him, and his sleep went from him. He was not able to sleep because of how badly he felt about what was taking place. So the king arose early in the morning and went in haste to the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting. Which means aggrieved, with a lamenting or grieved voice to Daniel. And he spake to Daniel, saying, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? And then Daniel said to the king, O live forever. My God did send his angel, and he shut the lions' mouths, so they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And, O king, I have done no wrong before you. He was a man of principle, and the king knew this. So the king was exceedingly glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. He was taken up. No injury whatever was found to him, because God delivered him. And the king gave command that they bring those men who accused Daniel and cast them into the den of lions, their children and their wives. And the lions overpowered them and broke their bones in pieces before they ever came to the bottom of the den. Now, there's a scripture that comes to my mind in Proverbs 26:27, says that you will fall into the pit that you have dug for others. Can you think of another example who fell into the pit that he was digging for another gentleman during the time of Esther? Right? We all know about Haman plotting to have Mordecai put to death, had the gallows built, was going to hang him on it. And Haman was like second in the kingdom at that particular time. And, Mordecai told Esther that something's got to be done. This is what you need to do. And she kind of had a little bit of fear, which is understandable. And she went back and forth. Finally, she makes this awesome statement, right? I'll go before the king. And if the king doesn't put on the scepter, you die, right? I'll go before the king. What were her words? If I die, I die. And she went before the king. He held out his scepter. And then she ends up inviting him and Haman, right? She has this plan that she was able to come up with. And they went in, had dinner with her, and then she invites them the next night to another dinner. Haman's feeling really good. You know, the queen's invited me to dinner with the king. Of course, she ends up telling the king about Haman's plan, right? Haman's going to have me killed and my people. And he says, what do you mean? And she tells him who she, I don't know if he knew who she was or not, but king got upset and mad and went out into the balcony. Haman knew his goose was what? His goose was cooked. And so he fell down on the bed next to the queen, basically not trying to take advantage of her, just wanting her to have the king show some mercy on his. Anyway, when the king came back, he's where he shouldn't have been. So the king told his servants to do what? Take Haman out and hang him on the platform that he had built for Mordecai. So he dug a pit for Mordecai, and he fell in it. God takes care of his own in miraculous ways. Psalm 15. God also admires individuals who will stand by their principles and by their words. Notice Psalm 15, beginning in verse 1. Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? And who may dwell on your holy hill? He who walks upright, who works righteousness, and speaks the truth in his heart, is a person of character and a person of principle. He who does not backbite with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor does he take up a reproach against his friend, in whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honors those who fear the Lord. He who swears to his own hurt and does not change. You know, sometimes we can make a promise that we'll do something. A day later we find out, that's going to be rather painful. I said I would do this, but I've got this opportunity now to go see a Rangers baseball game that day I promised to go over to the widow's house. Yeah, he doesn't change. He goes to work even though he has, box seats at a ball game given to him by somebody else for that particular time. He who does not put out his hand at usury, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things should never be moved. Now, Barnes note says this about this individual. That is, who does not show respect to a man, a base or bad character on account of his wealth, his position, his rank. He estimates character as it is in itself, and not as derived from rank, relationship, or station. That's the man or woman of great principle. Not only was he a man of principle, Daniel was also a man of purity. He was a man of purity. His opponents could not find any fault in him. We already read that a little bit, right? We're going to look at it again. He was faultless when it came to management of his business affairs. Notice Daniel chapter 6, verse 1. We read this earlier, but I want to read it for this particular point. It says, "It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps." Verse 3, "Then this Daniel distinguished himself above all the governors because of an excellent spirit that was in him. The king thought about making him, setting him over the whole realm." So it says, "The satraps, the governors, sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom." Surely, anyone in that type of position has done something to benefit himself. He's done something to ingratiate himself and gained wealth. He's had to cheat somewhere. He's had to do something wrong. We're going to search it out. Kind of like what's going on today, you know, with the Democratic Party. You know, trying to search out anything and everything to specifically get Trump, but also any Republican. So they sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful. Nor was there any error or fault found in him. So they say, "We should not find any charge against Daniel lest we find it against him concerning the law of God." So they searched, trust me, high and low, looking for any way to charge Daniel, finding any fault, but they couldn't. He was perfect in the management of his business affairs. And of course, this helped to explain his rise to his position of responsibility and power in all the governance, all the kingdoms where he was a captive. First Timothy, chapter 4. We as Christians must also maintain purity of conduct. Purity of conduct. 1 Timothy, chapter 4, beginning at verse 12. Paul tells Timothy, "Let no one despise your youth, but be an example," a person of purity. "Be an example to the believers," and notice, "in word, in conduct, in love, in spirit, in faith, in purity." So Timothy doesn't just say be an example. He actually outlines specifically to Daniel the type of example he was to be in the areas. "Until I come, give attention to reading, to exhortation, to doctrine. Do not neglect the gift that is in you, which was given by prophecy with the laying on of hands of the eldership. Meditate on these things. Give yourself entirely to them, that your progress may be evident to all." Daniel's progress was evident to all. The eunuch at the beginning, to the different kings over the kingdoms. And our progress should be evident to all, how we conduct ourselves. "Take heed to yourself and to the doctrine. Continue in them, for in doing this, you will save both yourself and those who hear you, who listen, who pay attention to you." Now, Life Application Commentary is really good in this section. You know, really good. I was looking at a few commentaries and what it had to say. And so I wrote down, or actually copied off with my printer, where Life Application Commentary says this: "Don't let anyone look down on you because you are young. The Greek word denotes young as anyone below age 40. By this time, Timothy was probably in his 30s. Although he was not a youth, he may have been considerably younger than some believers in his congregation. After serving under Paul, they may have looked down on this younger man who was put in charge of their church. Timothy could not control anyone's prejudice. That's something all of us should realize. Okay? You cannot control anyone else's prejudice. Timothy could not control anyone else's prejudice about his age, but he was not to be intimidated. He must not give anyone ammunition to use his youthfulness against him by being a man of purity, a man of a principle. Dropping on down, it says, but set an example for the believers in speech, in life, in love, in faith, and purity. We just read that. This is wise advice from a wise church planter and leader. Paul knew firsthand that the potential for problems in any church where people of a variety of religious backgrounds, cultures, and ages come together. Timothy's character, and not his age, would determine his authority to lead. Timothy's character. Paul called Timothy's specific role an example, meaning he was to be a pattern or a model. Whatever his age, Timothy was not to follow, was not to allow anyone to minimize his role, but he was persist in being a good example. Now you can read many places in the Bible where God, Christ in particular, continually says, set a good example. Matthew 11:29. Don't read these. You don't need to turn to these. Where he says, take my yoke upon you and learn from me. Learn from his example of gentleness and humility. Philippians 3:17 says, join with others in following my example, Paul said. 1 Thessalonians 1:6. You became imitators of me and the Lord. And so you became a model to all the believers. An example. In 1 Timothy 1:6. In me, Christ Jesus might display his unlimited patience as an example for those who would believe on him. So, the Bible is filled with the fact that our example needs to be like Daniel's, you know, a man of purity. Now, Life Application Commentary also has another good section here. It goes on to say, regardless of your age, God can use you. So I don't care if you're a teenager, God can use you. Whether you're young or old, don't think of your age as a handicap. Live so others can see Christ in you. And he goes on to say, Timothy was not left to ponder how Paul expected him to be an example. I mentioned that earlier, right? Paul didn't just say, be an example. He told him specific things to be mindful of. Paul expected him to be an example. Rather than offering general motivation to be an example, the old apostle issued a checklist. He was to be an example in speech. Our words create impressions that either facilitate or complicate all other communication. Timothy was to speak with gentle authority while avoiding useless argumentative conversations. He was to be an example in life. Our lifestyle, as well as our specific behaviors, must be consistent with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Timothy was to conduct himself as a representative of Jesus Christ, even in the details of daily living. Third example, Paul told Timothy was that of love. When we say the right words, live by the right way, we show love. We're demonstrating a useful way of life. Faith. Sooner or later, people around us will need to understand what motivates our speech, our life, and our love. A genuine combination of the above will present to others a way of life filled with hope. They may attempt to deflect God's overtures through us by saying, that stuff works for you, it can never work for me. We will have to remind them of our humanity and point out that we are not perfect in every sense of the word, but we do try to be an example of faith. And faith, again, comes by how? Hearing the word of God. And then purity was the last one that Paul, you know, wrote to Timothy. Purity. Paul ended this list with a rarely used term for virtue and chastity. As used here, the word implies integrity and consistency and reinforces the entire list. Reinforces the entire list that Paul was giving. Perhaps Paul even had the idea of transparency in mind. The above qualities were to be developed not just for public display, but as a uniform texture of Timothy's life. I thought, you know, that the Life Application Commentary put that really well. We too should be men and women of purity in our conduct. Lastly, Paul was a man, and this last point kind of ties all the others together. Daniel was a man of prayer. He was a man of prayer. Daniel 6. We read this earlier, so I won't necessarily turn to it, but I do have it in my notes. Daniel 6, verse 10. Remember, after he knew the writing was signed, what did he do? He went to his upper room, kneeled down on his knees three times that day and prayed, giving thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. He knelt in prayer, a demonstration of his humility. He prayed three times daily, a demonstration of his continual dependence upon God. He gave thanks in the midst of persecution, a demonstration of his gratitude and the fact that he had not lost sight of God's blessings. And his prayers were a custom since his early days. Four things you could take from that one verse. Demonstrating his persistence and faithfulness in his service to God. So is it not likely that his custom to pray so diligently helped him to remain a man of purpose, principle, and purity? Despite his rise to power and prominence over the empires? I think all of us would do well to follow Daniel's example, to learn the lessons that Daniel had for us. One of the finest servants that God has ever had. Don't get me wrong, God has had a lot of fine servants. But we're specifically talking about Daniel today, so we'll focus on how wonderful a life he lived in kingdoms with great prominence without compromising who he was as an individual. So my concluding statement is, would you dare to be a Daniel? Would we dare to be a Daniel? I think all of us want to be. And sometimes when we read these things, we say, wow, that's inspirational. I feel so bad. I see where I've fallen short in so many areas. Well, you know, the wonderful thing about that is every human being has, including Daniel. It doesn't list what he did, where he might have sinned, but according to chapter 9, he does list and pray for his own forgiveness for his sins, as well as the forgiveness of the nation. But I think any one of us would be very pleased to be, shall we say, maybe even just a partial Daniel, right, in the life that we lived. And the thing is, 1 John chapter 2, to me, is one of my favorite passages because it gives me hope in the lives that I live and the mistakes that I make. And if you don't think I've made any mistakes and fallen short, you can ask my wife. She's with me today. She'll be happy to share with you, but I'm asking her not to, all of my faults and frailties. But 1 John chapter 2 says, don't sin. That's our MO. I don't think any of us want to sin, but we do. John says, don't sin. And then he continues because he knows that we will. Don't sin. But if you do, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus the Christ, as the propitiation or the forgiveness of our sins, and not just ours, but the entire world. So, you know, I look at that scripture and say, I don't want to sin, but I know that if I do, you know, Christ is right there willing to forgive me. willing to help me, just like he is you. So let's dare to be a Daniel by becoming a person of purpose, principle, purity, and prayer.